Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts, a part-time program offering adults the opportunity to earn a graduate degree in interdisciplinary study. Information session October 1st, mla.stanford.edu.
Stories about when life takes an unexpected turn.
I thought, oh my God, is this my brother? I didn't ever think he had it in him.
That's On the Leap, a new podcast from KQED, launching October 6th.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, some people go to great lengths to help others, even when it comes at a high personal cost. A couple adopts 20 orphans. A woman donates a kidney to a stranger. A man starts a leper colony. New Yorker staff writer Larissa McFarquhar profiles these extreme do-gooders and others like them in her book, Strangers Drowning. And we'll hear about what drives these rare individuals and consider with McFarquhar how much we can and should help others. Forum is next after this. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're going to talk about something called the psychology of extreme altruism or do-gooderism. And do-gooderism doesn't mean just doing good. It means doing good in a sense of duty or higher calling or a commitment that sometimes goes beyond, let's say, what we normally associate with do-gooding. It's uber do-gooding or something along those lines. And Larissa McFarquhar has written a book all about this, profiling people who fall into this category. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book. It's called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. And good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, I put the question to listeners earlier, you know, people who adopt 20 kids or give a kidney to a stranger or start a leper colony, this is not necessarily what we think of as ordinary human behavior. I want to talk about some of these people that you profile here specifically. And in many cases, we're talking about people who put obviously their own needs, but even the needs of their family or their community behind being altruistic for others in a general sense. Are they wired differently, do you think, than we are? Or are they just a different subgenre of humanity?
I don't think they're wired differently. I think we would like to think they were because that would let us off the hook, right? These are different people and we can't hope to do what they do. But the impression I have from talking to these people is that though they do extraordinary things that most of us couldn't imagine doing, they're the same as us. You know, you mentioned the couple who adopted 20 kids in addition to the two biological kids they had. I thought before I met them, these must be the kind of people who embrace chaos, who love the feeling of having just stuff going on all over the place and noise and craziness and all kinds of stuff. No, they're just like the rest of us. They're driven crazy by chaos too. But they overcome that because they think there are all these children who need a family, who need parents, and we can give them a home. And so we're going to put up with a little chaos.
They look at children and say,
I'm sorry?
They look at certain children and say, they belong to us, we belong to them. That's almost a sense of a connection right away, even just looking at certain children.
Yes. I talked to a number of people besides the Badeaux who adopted special needs kids. And many of them said that they would look through – they have they're not catalogs exactly, but they have publications with pictures of children who need families, and you look through the photographs, and all of them describe this feeling of coming across certain photographs and thinking, that's my child. I need to go get that child. They're somehow not with me, and I need to go pick them up.
But as far as different wiring, you know, you talk about this fellow who starts a leper colony in India, and it's right out of the Life of Pi almost. He decides to let his kid go to challenge the kid's courage where a tiger is roaring or has been roaring. That sounds like different wiring to me.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about this guy is I think we often have a cliched notion of a do-gooder as a kind of a sap, as a kind of a sort of sweet but kind of maybe not very forceful person. And that's one of the cliches I wanted to overturn. These people are towering and tough. And
you call them relentless.
They are relentless. They are relentless and strong, and they overcome obstacles. So this man that you're mentioning, Baba Amte, founded this leprosy colony in the wilderness. There was nothing there. There was no water. There was no houses. It was really desert. I mean, it wasn't desert, but it was wilderness. And he brought with him, I think it was 9 or 10 leprosy patients and his two tiny children. I think they were both under the age of 3, and his wife and several dogs. And they built themselves huts out of sticks to have shelter before they could build proper housing. And in the first few months they were there, all of their dogs were captured and eaten by panthers. And the panthers did not eat the children, but they might have done. And that was a risk they took.
So we're talking, for the most part here, I mean, of people with, you say they're almost always at war. I mean, that relentlessness again. But people who have a higher morality and maybe an extreme morality for themselves?
They do. I mean, these are not people who are nice but otherwise normal. These are not people who just sort of volunteer in homeless shelters, though that's a great thing to do. These are people who set out to live as ethical a life as possible. They're people who almost never ask themselves, what do I want, but only what should I do? And they don't think, well, I've done this good thing today. I'm now free to go off and spend the rest of the day as I like. Their whole life, their whole self, their whole mind is dedicated to helping other people.
And that even means, in some cases, making their own children, for example, less important or of tertiary importance to other children who are hungry or in need. You've got a portrait of one man here who is an animal rights, kind of out of the Peter Singer mold, activist, and who feels it's more important to take care of these cooped-up chickens than his father who's going into hospice. I mean, there are priorities that most people would see as kind of wacky in many ways.
Well, they're certainly unusual. I mean, I did come to feel that this is the great dividing line between the sort of dedicated do-gooder that I'm writing about and the rest of us. You know, I think we customarily think that the reason most of us don't do more to help others is that we're selfish, we're lazy, we like our stuff, you know, we don't get around to it. All that's true. But there's a much deeper conflict that these do-gooders have to face, which is the conflict between caring for strangers and caring for their families. And if you're a really dedicated do-gooder, at some point, caring for your family is going to conflict with caring for strangers, and you have to make that choice. And it's a hard choice for these people. It's especially hard when you're a parent, I think. I mean, the animal rights activist you're mentioning did not have children, partly for this reason, because he did not want to take time away from his cause to take care of his children. But for the adopters that we were talking about earlier, it took a different form. They had started out with, let's say, 4 children. They had 2 biological children and adopted 2. And they originally thought that was going to be their family. But there were more than 2 children in the world who needed parents. And so they started adopting more and taking more children in who became their children. But of course, before they had adopted them, they were still strangers. And as their family grew bigger, before they adopted new children, they would have family meetings and say, we're thinking about adopting, let's say, 4 more. And at a certain point, their children started to protest. They say, our family is too big. You can't keep adopting. We're helping taking care of them. You don't have the time, the attention for all of us. Please stop. And that cut them to the quick, just like it would to any parent. But whereas most parents would say, all right, I won't. I can't do this to my children. They said, well, we feel terrible that you don't want more kids in the family, but there are these children out there who are still strangers, but who desperately need parents. And their need moves us as much as your protests.
Our guest is Larissa McFarker, and her new book is called Strangers Drowning. As long as we're talking about children, I mean, these are people who just had to keep adding to their family, who were, as to use your word again, relentless about it. But we recently had on Paul Chavez, the son of Cesar Chavez, who always seemed to me to be almost a beatified, saintly figure. But the cause his son loved him and so forth. But he said, my father was dedicated to the cause. He couldn't give me the attention that, I mean, even on that level, this is often operating. We see with people perhaps who love their children, but who feel that the cause is taking them away from their children, but the cause is of elevated importance.
I think so. I mean, the reason you mentioned earlier that these people are always at war, I brought up wartime. I think do-gooders, it's always wartime because this is a context in which their behavior doesn't seem so strange to the rest of us. Because if your country is at war, everyone feels the need to put aside their more parochial and familial concerns and help the larger cause. And in wartime, it's thought to be patriotic and noble to leave your family behind for the sake of a cause rather than strange and perverse. And so for these do-gooders, it's always wartime. They know that even if you're not at war, there are always people in desperate need and their causes are always as urgent as war seems to most people. And so to them, it does not seem bad to spend less time with their families and more time with strangers.
In some instances, you would think that this kind of selflessness and higher cause may also be a kind of self-hagiography where they're maybe even somewhat narcissistic or, you know, want to think of themselves as being so selfless that it intrudes upon their commitments and their other concerns where loved ones are concerned, for example.
You know, I think that's another impression that we have of such people, that it's kind of vanity to be doing so much good all the time. I guess I would say, first of all, even if it were, what's wrong with that? I think there are certain sins that are overvalued in our culture that give us a kind of excuse or an alibi.
I didn't say it was sinful.
Yeah, well, okay, that's a loaded word. You're right. But so we get annoyed with people who are self-righteous, who are proud of the good things they do and the pride they seem to take in that. That, I think, is not so bad because what's worse is not doing anything. If there's somebody who spends their life helping the homeless and feels kind of proud about it, isn't that better than someone who is a delightful cynic who never does anything at all? But actually, the people I'm talking about have such a strong sense of duty that they don't really feel self-righteous and proud because they feel they're only doing their duty. So if you go into a store and you spend 10 minutes there and you don't steal even one thing, you don't pat yourself on the back. Of course you didn't steal. That's just what you're supposed to do. That's how they feel.
What drew you to this subject? Do you have a friend with this condition? Or
condition? Goodness. You know, I think what drew me to it in part was a puzzle. We all know that giving something, whether it's a small thing like a little bit of money or a seat on the bus, or whether it's a big thing like a lot of money or even one of your kidneys, giving something away often makes you feel happier than keeping it.
There's even empirical evidence to support
much,
what you
yes,
say.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We all know this. We don't need the data. You know, everyone's experienced this. So why don't we give more? You know, even if you assume that people are selfish and they're only out for their own pleasure, it's still strange.
Well, this kind of altruism almost gives the lie to the kind of selfish gene notion or evolutionary biology notion that we are by nature selfish.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that you bring up evolutionary biology because for much of the 20th century, it was assumed that altruism is just selfishness in disguise by biologists. Darwin himself believed in altruism. He believed that there was a reason that altruists were selected for because groups that cooperate can defeat groups that do not. In other words, if a group of people consists of members that are willing to sacrifice for one another, they will prosper more than a bunch of selfish people who are just always out for to kill the next guy. No one was convinced by that for many, many decades. But recently, this idea of group selection has been revived and made legit again in biology and evolutionary psychology. So it may seem that evolution does not give the lie to altruism after all.
Larissa McFarker is our guest. Her book, again, is Strangers Drowning. And people like this seem to elicit all kinds of responses. I mean, some ambivalence you've admitted that you have, but also sometimes anger, hostility. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I started this project.
Bafflement.
Well, bafflement, yes, for sure. I started this project interviewing people who gave one of their kidneys to a stranger. And I wasn't thinking about hostility at that point. I just wanted to know who these people were and what their lives were like and what other moral decisions they made. But I was startled to discover how much skepticism and even hostility they faced. Their family would often be angry at them for not preserving that kidney in case a family member needed it. Their friends thought they were bizarre. Why would you subject yourself to this serious surgery for no reason? I mean, not no reason, but to their friends, no reason. And doctors were most skeptical of all. In order to donate a kidney to a stranger, you have to go through a battery of psychological tests, the premise of which is, what's wrong with you? There must be something totally psycho about you.
Well, we pathologize
this kind of behavior. Yes, absolutely. And
I called it a condition, so I'll retract from that. But yeah.
No. Thank you for bolstering my case. It's a very widespread assumption that there must be something wrong with you if you are not a basically self-interested person who, insofar as you give to others, you give to your family, which is basically an extension of yourself. And so I got really interested in this skepticism and this hostility. And I think some of it is very simple and petty. You know, we're selfish. We don't want to be shown up. We don't want to be told, even implicitly, that we're living our lives the wrong way. But I don't think it's just that. I do think that there is something deeper and more poignant, that the desire to take care of your family before strangers is a very, very deep and valuable human urge.
Or to give to your community before strangers. I mean, you know, there's a lot of kind of people you're talking about also elicit pity, strangely enough, or pathos on some level, too. And you wonder how this all relates to the present crisis in Europe of Syrian refugees and Afghan and Iraqi refugees and so forth. I mean, it almost seems cultural in some ways. The Hungarians, for example, and the Slovenians don't want to let these people in. The Germans let in 500,000, and so it goes. I mean, you know, people look at the Germans from the standpoint of being Hungarian and they think, what the hell are they doing? You know, we can't measure up to that. And there's a good deal of anger probably in response to it as well. Are they saying that, you know, they're more generous than we are and all of that sort of thing? This is extreme behavior, though, isn't it? When we come down to it, you call it extreme altruism, you call it a number of other things, but relentless idealism and so forth. But it is extreme behavior.
It is extreme, except if you consider the situation extreme. I think part of the moral drive that these people possess is a vividness of imagination. You know, for most of us, if we saw a child drowning in front of us, we would consider it obviously our duty to save that child. But most of the time, there isn't a child drowning right in front of us. And so we forget that there are people in need all the time. And obviously now we're reminded because we see these terrible, terrible photographs of the refugees in Europe, literally strangers drowning. But most of the time, we're not reminded of this need. The difference between us and these type of people that I'm writing about is that they perceive this need all the time. And I think it is a kind of mental vividness. You know, they don't need to have someone crying for help right in front of them. They know, as we all know if we think about it, that there is a need all the time. So for them, the behavior is not extreme because the times are extreme. And for them, it's always a situation where there are boatloads of refugees drowning because they know that, you know, there are people starving and living just as horrible elsewhere.
It seems, though, the way you portray some of these people, it's almost as if they're possessed by the need to help or to be altruistic or to be generous or however you want to characterize or to define it. It's almost like a kind of possession.
I think it is. I mean, I think this is another very difficult thing that any successful do-gooder has to do. Typically, these kinds of people, when they're younger, are overwhelmed by guilt, overwhelmed by a sense of suffering, overwhelmed by a thought of debt and what they are obliged to do. And it's very difficult to cope with. And what they need to do is, in order not to continue in that overwhelmed state that's really not going to enable them to do anything sensible, is to sort of build walls around their sense of duty. They have to narrow it down. They have to decide, okay, I'm going to help children in need of parents, but I'm just not going to worry about the homeless, or I'm going to help chickens.
Well, I'm not going to worry about my own parents or my own children as much.
Right,
or
something. I mean, they have to narrow it down. Otherwise, they'd go insane, and that wouldn't do anyone any good. So I think you're right that in their early days, when they're young, there is a kind of sense of possession, a kind of sense that the world's need is out of control and they don't know which way to turn. But they manage it. They're tough. And they, you know, in a way, in order to be a very moral person, you have to embrace a kind of immorality, which is, in order to open your heart to some people, you have to close your heart and your door and your wallet to others.
I'm thinking about the famous line of the poet William Wordsworth, "A child is father to the man." You do see traces of this beginning fairly early on. I mean, not to get too psychoanalytic, but it begins early ages, early stages of life.
It does. And, you know, it's funny. We were talking earlier about pathologization of these virtuous people. And I started out this book kind of on sides. I wanted to just reject that. And I was reading various theories about why someone might grow up to have an extreme sense of moral duty. And one of them is the theory of the parentified child, the idea that for a child who has at least one non-functional parent, either, say, because of alcoholism or because of mental illness, or for some reason that parent is not functioning as a parent, the child often may feel that it's their fault that there's something wrong with their family, and they feel a drive to fix that. Or even if they don't feel it's their fault, they feel they need to take over the functions of that parent that's not doing their job. They need to take care of their younger siblings. They need to take care of their other parent. They need to fix things. And that child grows up as an adult to have an enlarged sense of moral duty. And when I first encountered this theory, I thought, this is just more psychologists, you know, making excuses, calling these people weird so that the rest of us feel better. But then I looked at the people in my book, and it's very striking, I have to admit, that almost all of them are one such – had started out that way, that they have one parent that is either an alcoholic or severely mentally ill. Not all of them, but a striking number of them. And, you know, mind you, this is not a scientific sample, but that did make me think, okay, there are reasons for this sense of duty.
We're talking to the author of Strangers Drowning, Larissa McFarker, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker and who also will be talking at the Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland, 7 o'clock tonight. And it's an event put on with a great good place for books. These people could almost be called saintly. You would, in some instances, perhaps not hesitate to call them saintly. Are there characteristics? We got this big controversy recently about Junipero Serra. I don't want to get into that, about who should be a saint and who shouldn't be a saint. But we do identify saints with halos over their head and doing these extreme kind of idealistic acts or selfless acts. Do you find commonality between these people and maybe some of those who are canonized?
Well, I haven't made a study of Christian saints or Hindu saints or saints from other traditions for that matter. But certainly I think that there is a commonality in the sense of a willingness and ability to devote oneself single-mindedly to a moral cause or a religious cause, no matter what the cost. But there's a difference. One of the people in my book is a Methodist minister from Baltimore. And I was asking her what she thought was the difference between people who are morally driven, who are believers, and people who are atheists. And because unquestionably there are morally driven people.
Most of these people
are
Christian backgrounds, are they not?
No, not at all. Not at all.
That you profile?
No. Some are, some aren't. Atheists. There are the animal rights activists from a Jewish background.
Right, but the majority.
I'd have to count,
yeah,
but maybe.
Okay. Anyway, I got that
anyhow,
impression. Yeah. But
she said that there is a difference in the sense that if you're an atheist, you feel like we're alone here. We have to, if anything's going to be fixed in this world, it's up to us. We need to fix it.
I need to fix this and give the number out. Listeners can join us. In fact, we invite them to do so. You may have some thoughts about this, even about religious differences. But do you know an extreme altruist? Are you one? And how do you deal with them? And how do you react to that behavior? Our toll-free number is available, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Larissa McFarker, and she will be at Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland tonight, an event at 7 o'clock with a great good place for books. Her book is called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. And I know there's many of you who can talk to that topic from a personal standpoint, either from your own experiences and how you see the world and try to do good and all of that, but maybe also from the perspective of how you're wanting, as I often feel when I meet these kind of selfless people, or maybe how you should be striving for a higher bar or something along those lines. But also, what does it mean to be this selfless, to even in some instances put family and loved ones and children and, being not as important as the cause itself? Do you know an extreme altruist? And I know some of you may have some stories and may want to join us with short rendered narratives. But what about extreme altruism in general? Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. There are other ways you can join the program. You can, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page, or go to our website and put questions or comments there. The website is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, and we're going to go right to your calls without tarrying here. We'll go to San Diego first. Margaret, welcome. You're on.
Good morning. I want to comment on what the author was saying about being overwhelmed, because it, as someone who basically spends every waking hour outside of work doing things that basically around animals and wildlife sanctuaries and such, because that's kind of my thing, one of the things that happens to me is that I get overwhelmed at how much work there is to be done, and extremely frustrated and sometimes even angry when I look around and see people that aren't doing it. I just don't get it. I was raised this way. My entire family is this way. And it's a responsibility. That's sort of how we were raised. And I really believe that in my heart. And sometimes it's just overwhelming. And so to your point, I just have to focus on the little things that I can do in my little world, because otherwise I will just go crazy.
Well, you raise, I think, an important point. I'd like to hear what Larissa has to say about this. I mean, there are probably those who feel like the caller, I'm being socially responsible, I'm being generous. Why aren't more people, more citizens behaving in the way I'm behaving?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that puzzles and frustrates and angers everyone I write about in my book. They don't get it either, because to them, they're not doing anything special. They're just doing something that everyone should do. They don't consider themselves some strange, saintly creature. They just think, you know perfectly well that there's all this need and suffering out there. Why are you not helping too? But they find ways to manage that anger, because if they spent their whole lives being frustrated with other people for not doing what they're doing, they would just go crazy. So they just focus on what their work is and try not to think about what other people are not doing.
Margaret, thank you for your call. Good to hear from you. We actually asked our listeners on social media where the line should be drawn when it comes to helping others. Let me just read some responses. Charles writes, if your generosity causes you and your family not to have the latest and greatest, not a problem. If you miss a meal to give to others, not a problem. If you and your family are malnourished, having your basic utilities cut off, or lose your home because of helping others, big problem. Take care of your basic needs, then help others. And Jeffrey tweets, as Dr. Seuss said, life is a great balancing act. Compassion for self, family, friends, others, environment are all important. And Michelle says, we had our season of extreme altruism. It changes the dynamics of everything. We choose to give generously from our earnings instead. And we'll bring on more of your calls. And we go next to Jacqueline. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was moved by a story that I read a while ago about a Danish man, a middle-aged Danish man, who was volunteering at a place for people in India, the dying people in India. And he said he was doing it because he had lived a very good life. He had everything he ever wanted, anything that money could buy. He could even dress very well. And then now, in his older age, he wanted to give back. So to me, this is all about gratitude. And I wanted to know then how would you categorize this man? I mean, how does gratitude factor into all this talk about altruism?
That's a very, very interesting question, because gratitude is not typically the motive for the kind of person I'm writing about. They are driven in the beginning much more by a sense of duty and guilt. I think gratitude is what drives the rest of us. You know, I was talking to one of the people I'm writing about. She's her name is Julia Wise, and she gives away 50% of what she earns to the charities that she has determined give ease the most suffering for the least money. And she was asking me as a normal person, you know, how do we encourage more normal people to give? To give more, and at what stage in life? Because she's found that young people who are just starting out in life, it's relatively easy for them to contemplate not adding more bells and whistles to their lives. But it's much harder for people in the middle of life to cut back. But then she and I had met several people who, after they'd had children, after they'd lived a sort of conventional, enjoyable life, then wanted to change and give back, as you say, out of a sense of gratitude. And I think that's another model. It's not the model that I'm writing about, but it's a model that's more accessible perhaps to many of us, to want to give out, not out of a sense of duty and debt and guilt, but gratitude after a well-lived life.
Like we said earlier, though, these are people who just need to do what they do. I mean, it's not, I mean, maybe framed in higher duty or morality, as you're suggesting, but they're compelled almost, aren't they?
It's true. And I mean, in terms of what the previous caller brought up, in terms of not understanding why other people don't feel obliged, Baba Amte, the man who started a leprosy colony in India, he would tell people who proposed to come and work with him, don't do this because you think you're supposed to. You're doing this because you want to. You're doing this because this is what you want to do with your life. And I want that to be very clear to you, because if you're doing it because you think you're so saintly, I don't want you to work with me. That is not going to last. You have to understand and acknowledge that this is the life you have chosen for your own reasons.
Our next caller, Alberto. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Michael, for taking my call. I wanted to just make two points that your guest had mentioned. One about the family where the mother and father were adopting children, more and more children, and their other children, their biological children, were protesting, saying that they weren't spending enough time with them. And I think it's important to remember the value of, you know, not just the act of adopting more children, but the time you're spending with your own children. I mean, there is a value in that, not just in the act in and of itself. For example, anybody can just donate money to a cause. And then there's a value in donating your time, your energy, and your effort. The other thing, too, that I wanted to mention was the reason behind, right, the motivation behind giving. There are some people who do validate their existence by constantly giving and giving. And if it's out of a sense of guilt, you're not actually giving for the cause. You're doing it to alleviate your own, you know, your own sense of guilt. That's actually more towards yourself.
Alberto, that was a little bit of what I was hitting at earlier. Yeah. I mean, I think it could be interpreted that way. Let's hear from Larissa McFarker on this. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I do want to make it very clear that you draw a distinction between their own children and their adopted children. That's not how the Badeaus see it at all. They don't draw any distinction between the children, the two children they had biologically and their adopted children. They're all equally loved and feel equally theirs. But you're right that there is a point before the children enter the family when those new children, the potential new children, are not yet part of the family. And, you know, it's true. There's a conflict there. I mean, they will have more time and attention to give the children they already have if they don't bring in new kids. That's true. But that's the difference between them and the rest of us. They think, but there are these children out there that need parents so much and will not get them unless we bring them into our family. And that is a need just as moving and important as the need of our children for a little more of our time.
Alberto, I thank you for the call. I want to go to some of the emails from listeners. I've almost could have predicted this one. Dina in Berkeley writes, I have to take issue with the characterization of atheists. We do not think we are alone, and that's why we have to be altruistic. That's a Christian perception. We know we are all related, one people, and that's why we help others. I don't know if you can speak if she can speak for all atheists, but there's that comment. Here's Bill who writes, I wonder if people who are extremely altruistic might have something in common with hoarders. Instead of collecting objects or animals, they're collecting or accumulating good deeds or, as noted, children, perhaps to the detriment of their own family or their family's comfort or financial security. A listener writes, several months ago, Margaret Cho made many free appearances on the streets of San Francisco to help raise donations for the homeless. She was met with such hostility from some quarters for her efforts as if she was crazy for doing it only for selfish motives. There again is what we were talking about before. Christine writes online, David Foster Wallace said once that there is no such thing as atheism, and this is water. Everybody worships something. Our choice, he said, was what to worship. The people your guest describes worship duty, and just as Wallace explained, the result is all but inevitable. They can never give enough. Another listener says, for those who consider themselves part of a whole, one with everything, if you will, altruism is a normal impulse, just as any other normal impulse, eating, sleeping, etc. If the other is part of me, as my finger or hand, then the impulse to help that other is the same as helping myself. So getting a lot of interesting comments here, and you can join us again. Toll free 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Here's John. John, you're on.
Good morning, Michael and Larissa. This is such a fascinating subject, Michael. I hope you do a sequel in the near future. I'd like to push back very strongly on this issue that these wonderful people who give so much of themselves to others are somehow wired differently than the rest of us. I think that we are all basically wired the same, at least most of us, and that we all need to think a little bit deeper about what we give to our society. When I read these stories about what other people give in such great amounts to other people, I feel like a real piker, but I know I could do more. And I think one of the things that can be done is already being done in some schools, and that is requiring community service as part of the curriculum to graduate. And I'd like your guest to comment on that, that maybe we need to try to build in these altruistic habits.
Well, I couldn't agree more that there is nothing bizarre or wired differently about these people. They certainly behave differently from most of us, but I completely agree with you that to imagine that there's something pathological or weird or even just different about them fundamentally is to just furnish ourselves with an alibi. I completely agree. And I also agree that making normal the idea of helping other people would be the way to go. I think that, part of the reason the obvious reasons we don't give more is, the usual, we're selfish, we're lazy, we're just stuck in our conventional ruts, et cetera. And all that's true. But I think also another part of the reason is that we don't give more because we think it's normal not to give more. And if expectations change, we change. So we were talking earlier about wartime. I mean, if you change the situation that somebody is in, their behavior will change drastically. And so if you rearrange the expectations for what's a normal, acceptable way to live your life, then behavior will change as well. There's a person I profile in the book, a monk in Japan, and he decided that he needed to think about giving to others. His work is counseling suicidal people. He needs to think about giving to others just like eating and drinking and walking, just a very normal part of his life. Nothing special, nothing freighted, nothing strange. And that was the way that he was going to keep his sanity.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more of your calls and emails in just a moment. But, it goes without saying that there are, as we've indicated, people of all faiths of all faith backgrounds who fall into this category of extreme altruism. But there probably are strong cultural differences that need to be noted. I just assume that more of them are Christians because there is a lot of, when we think about saints and we think about Christianity is largely a giving ethos. But all religions tell us to be, I have to laugh when we think about all the religious wars that are going on and so forth, but tell us that the most important thing is to love our fellow man and woman. Nevertheless, you talk about, let's say, the Christian tradition, you're talking about something much more geared toward this kind of extreme altruism, at least in terms of the Gospels and what it teaches, than, say, Hinduism, Buddhism. Well, Buddhism has a lot of it, too, compassion and so forth, mindfulness. Judaism has a lot of it, but they're different kinds of ways of seeing acting altruistically, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that really intrigues me is that whereas, as you say, every religious and cultural tradition believes that it's good to give to others to some extent, there are profound differences when it comes to how you give to strangers versus family. In Judaism and Islam, it's required to give a certain amount to charity, to strangers, to help others. But it's also required to take care of your family. It's forbidden to give so much that you neglect your family, that you impoverish your family, that you even abandon them. Whereas in other traditions, such as Christianity or Buddhism, there's much more openness to the idea that in certain circumstances for certain people, family takes second place, that it's acceptable to follow the cause that seems most important to you, even if abandonment of your family is the price.
You mentioned before that a lot of these people come up in homes that have problems with alcohol and the like. But you also say the history of do-gooders is inseparable from the history of alcohol. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I became very intrigued by the origins of this sense that do-gooders are pathological. And there are some sketches in the book of certain historical and cultural trends in the West. And one of them in popular culture comes out of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Alcoholics Anonymous promoted the idea that alcoholism was not a sin, but a disease. And the Al-Anon, which was the group founded some decades later by the spouses of alcoholics, promoted the idea that trying to help an alcoholic stop drinking could be a symptom of the same disease too. And both of these were quite radical innovations, but it's the second one that had farther-reaching moral implications because, you know, if alcoholism is a disease or a sin, either way, you want to stop it. But if helping can be a disease too, especially the kind of tormented, entangled, devoted helping of a spouse of an alcoholic, then that makes a whole category of moral behavior look very different. And this founding idea of Al-Anon mutated over the decades until in the 70s and 80s, it became this idea of codependency, the idea that a person can be so preoccupied with helping that, in fact, they are preoccupied with controlling someone else's behavior, that their whole life becomes about controlling. Initially, it was about a romantic partner. There was a very successful book in the 80s called Women Who Love Too Much. And the idea that, yeah, well, it's hard to forget. And then no one's forgotten that title. And the idea was that there's something wrong with the women who try to fix their romantic partners. And then later that idea became used to apply to all kinds of helping to strangers as well as spouses.
I'm looking at an email from a listener here. It says, are these people codependent?
I mean, there you go. It's a very deep idea in our culture.
We'll go to more of your calls. Actually, one more email here. A listener writes, I haven't heard any mention of a heightened sense of empathy in my realm of people who care for abused animals with their own time and money. I know the main reason is empathy. It actually causes a person to feel pain when they see an animal suffering, so they're compelled to help. Unfortunately, it seems that people who care for animals are the least appreciated of all caregivers, but I'm guessing that there are some who work for human causes who also come at it from empathy.
Absolutely. I mean, it so happens that the animal rights advocate that I write about in my book is not particularly interested in animals. He devoted his life to their welfare because he felt that animals, and particularly chickens, were the most helpless, the most trodden on, the most brutally oppressed creatures on the earth, more than any human beings. And so he devoted himself to them for logical moral
but of course,
reasons.
To most people, it sounds ludicrous. So, you know, my dad's in hospice, but
chickens.
These chickens have to be cared for.
Chickens are doing very badly, though. You have to remember that.
No,
but,
certainly they are. Yeah.
But empathy is a part of it. We were talking a little bit about this earlier. I mean, I think one of the reasons that the kind of person I'm writing about is driven to do what they do is, well, I don't know if you'd define it as empathy, because there's an abstract quality to it. It's not, you know, all of us can feel empathy for someone right in front of us who is in pain, who's struggling, who needs help. But these people have empathy even for people they cannot see. They have a vivid moral imagination that allows them to feel the terribleness of suffering, even if it's on the other side of the world, experienced by people they will have no knowledge of and will never meet.
But look at that child that drowned, though, in the Syrian refugee. I mean, there was a visual image and people were so moved by it and empathic by it. Let me bring in our callers. And thanks for waiting. Diego, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me. Just a quick comment on the vivid imagination, sort of being able to see. I want to take that to sort of the realms where these extreme altruists, or, you know, whatever you decide to call them, that they see, instead of separating their family from the rest of the world, that maybe they just see the world itself as they're part of their family. So I know for some that they give time to animals or and whatnot, but I was just trying to figure out the sense where they're seeing this vivid imagination where they take that and take it beyond just their own parents and their own family and actually include the rest of the globe. Kind of like a toward a unified global humanity sort of sense inside of their own mentality. And I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
Yes, I think that's true, that there is a component of that. I mean, you're reminding me of something that Sue Bedeau told me. She's the wife of the couple who adopted 20 special needs kids. And at one point, she and her husband were saying, about a child that they had not yet adopted and had not yet even met or even seen a photograph of, that they felt this strong sense that that child was their family, was their child. And I said, what does that mean? What are you talking about? How can you feel love for a person that you haven't even seen a picture of, you have no knowledge of at all? And Sue said, it's kind of like when you're pregnant. When you first are pregnant, you haven't seen the baby inside you. You have no knowledge of it. And it barely even exists in the beginning. And yet you love it. And what is it that you love? It's so abstract, and yet it's not abstract at all. And that, to me, really answered the question. I thought, you know...
Sounds like a pro-life argument, too.
Yes. Well, in her case, it is, but I don't think it has to be. I mean, it's just, for me, it was an example of how even ordinary people can experience love for a creature that they have never seen, do not know, and barely even exists.
Again, we're talking with Larissa McFarker. If you've just joined us, her book is called Strangers Drowning, and we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to Susan. Good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Suzanne, no problem.
Suzanne,
good morning.
Hi.
I am the eldest of six preacher's kids, PKs for short, and I just really need to know if your author, I'm sorry, is it Alyssa?
Larissa.
Larissa, I apologize. If Larissa has spent, and I do mean, an equivalent amount of time speaking to the adult children of these wonderful givers who put aside the needs of their family. My mother passed away at age 50, 20 years ago, so she never got her turn. And I could go on with the negative results. It doesn't mean that I'm not also a giver and didn't teach my daughter to be a giver, but I looked for her interests. And I can't tell you how I've suffered, how much time I've gone on. And of the six of us, all three girls live 700 to thousands of miles away. I don't know what that says about it, but we all feel it has a lot to do with how our mother and us were all affected. My mom couldn't predict who would show up at the dinner table or how many. I could go on and on.
Well, Suzanne, you said you had a question here. Can you parse it for us?
Has she spent any real time, equivalent time, learning if these wonderful givers, children, those who have children, once they are adults and have time to reflect and so on, how they look back on it.
Yeah, what'd you learn from the
total
children?
Total respect, or as in my case, it took my second mom, my dad remarried, and it took 5 years of her changing, helping him to change into a person who respects his own family before I could start building a relationship with him.
Suzanne, let me cut to the chase here. You want to know what the effect was on the children, and Larissa, can you illuminate that for us?
Absolutely. I mean, the people I'm thinking of actually who most address your question, I spoke with them as sort of background for the book. I didn't end up writing about them, but the children of Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister, who they were very well known in the 70s and 80s. They were anti-nuclear protesters.
And anti-Vietnam.
And they got arrested many, many, many times for their protests.
And he was Father Berrigan, of course.
He was a priest, but he was not a priest once he married Liz McAllister, who had been a nun. Anyhow, they in the course of their protests, they got jailed many times, and they knew this would happen. And they had three tiny children, and they hoped that they wouldn't be jailed at the same time while their kids were young, but for one period, I think it was maybe 9 months, they were both in prison when their kids were at home. And they lived in a group house, so there were other adults around to take care of the kids, but they weren't parents. And the kids were very little. And I talked to those children. Those children are now in their 30s, and they have children of their own. And I asked them, you know, how they felt about that. And on the one hand, they've made a decision not to do that to their children. They say to their parent and uncle, Daniel Berrigan, who was also a very big activist in the same cause, no, I'm not going to get arrested. I'm going to be here for my children. On the other hand, they think their parents were heroes. They don't think they were wrong to do what they did. They fully believe in all their principles, but they're doing it differently.
Well, I'm looking at a question from a listener. We'll just let this stand. Maybe some people think we shouldn't teach our kids to be altruistic and give or donate. They think they need to come to that conclusion on their own. Agree? Disagree? Just forget. Right.
No, disagree.
Okay. I thought so. That's a whole subject for another day. Larissa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Larissa McFarker will be at the Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland this evening at 7 p.m., event that's co-sponsored by A Great Good Place for Books. And we are with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. This program is produced by Irene Iguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and our engagement producers, Amanda Stupai, our other producers, Susan Britton and Suki Lewis. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.